This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you all for coming. Firstly, it's a pleasure to be here at Robinson College as a Bright Fellow, so thank you for your hospitality. I'm absolutely thrilled and delighted to be here. I'm primarily here because I'm on a sabbatical year and working on a project concerning Arthur Cecil Pigou and the Cambridge tradition. So his role in that, and to facilitate that project, I've been spending a lot of time in archives around the college, around the university and various colleges and the library. Today I'm going to talk about the current paper that I'm working on, which is really a theory paper, and it comes out of two programs. I've developed a fairly large working profile on the work of Vilfredo Pareto, the Italian-Swiss economist, and there are some overlaps, and those overlaps have interested me, and it sort of made a transition from the Pareto program, if you like, where I've looked at his school of thought as it emerged in Italy, this emerging role of Pigou within the Cambridge school. I thought we'd start with a couple of photos, just to put them in perspective. That's a photo of Pigou just around the time he was appointed Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge. That's 1908. The paper that we're looking at today is 1917, so he's a little bit older. The Pareto photo is undated, but I'm guessing it's around the time he wrote his Manual of Political Economy, around 1906. So his work on monetary economics, as we're talking about today, was done in 1920, so it's somewhat later. So Pigou was a relatively young man, Pareto was a relatively old man at the time when we're dealing with this work. An interesting aspect of, or one of the interesting aspects of it, is that Pareto, in his career, started working in economics, but he always had this very broad definition of economics and was very interested in social sciences, or he switched between social sciences and sociology between them. In his economics, it's a fair bit in his economics. And then by about 1910, when he had completed writing his Manual of Political Economy, he devoted almost all his time to sociology. His treatise on sociology, his Trattato di Sociologia Generale, was published in 1916, and he published some other important papers around that period. So a curious thing is that this man in late in life suddenly returns to pure economics. He died in 1923. So around 1920-21, he starts to look at some of the fundamental issues in monetary economics. And I want to draw some of those links out as to why he did it at that stage of his career. So what do I hope to do today? I'm going to spend a fair bit of time on context, which will hopefully satisfy people who have been here with a primary interest in the question of equality and income distributions, and issues related to income distributions. The context I'm looking at here is not just the introduction to the paper that's on the web, but it's the introduction to a general program. Why, there's a sub-program I'm looking at with a comparison of Pigou and Pareto. Why should anyone, or why should I be looking at those two people? I'm trying to make the case that it's actually an intellectually interesting and important exercise with reference to some particular topics. So I'm going to look at context and spend a bit of time on that. And then with this paper, I want to formalise, do this fairly quickly, present Pigou's formalisation of the quantity theory, present Pareto's formalisation from the quantity theory from 1920 to 21. And I should say we're very lucky to have these. These papers were found in an archive by Fiorenzo Manati in Lausanne, the University of Lausanne, where Pareto was professor, and they're fragmented. So it's not a complete document, it's this fragmented preliminary work on essentially a critique of the quantity theory. So that's what I'm using in this paper. Those discovered papers were published in 2005. Then I want to go through the concerns of both Pigou and Pareto with the quantity theory and say, well, they both raise some fundamental issues that question or can question the dichotomy between the real sector and the monetary sector. Yet when we go to the next section, we look at the rhetoric is totally different. You have a very supportive rhetoric from Pigou on the quantitative theory, and you have a very, very dismissive and critical rhetoric from Pareto. And then I want to draw out a conclusion, and a conclusion in some ways is to say these are illustrative of differences that exist in the Lausanne School of Economics and the Cambridge School of Economics. They have a different approach to the discipline, and part of the reasons why they've come to these different rhetorical conclusions is based on the different views on what you can and can't do with economics. So that's the goal for this evening. Now, the context. The first thing to note is Pareto and Pigou are both prominent for their work in welfare economics. You have some scholars talk about Paretian welfare economics and others about Pigouvian welfare economics. Paretian welfare economics is typically linked to the first and second law of welfare economics, or it's linked typically to welfare ordering, to preference systems, whereas the Pigouvian system is typically linked to market failure. That is, how do you get a handle on externality? Questions of cardinalism or ordinalism are not the primary issue. The primary issue is the market failure and how you address it. There's an intellectual basis for a comparison. These people both have an interest in that one area that they both became well-known in our discipline for. Second point is that Pareto succeeded Léon Walras. He was the second-generation leader of the Lausanne School. In one way, he was the popularizer of the Lausanne School. When he took over from Léon Walras, he had to pick up 5 students in economics, and most of them couldn't understand what was being done. So the discipline was in a difficult way at the school, and Pareto was able to take over and make it thrive. So in some sense, he was a popularizer of that system, and then he added his own aspects to it. The same, too, is true of Pigou. I mean, if you consider the first generation of Cambridge as a school of thought, not as an institution in economics, because there were professors of economics before, but if we say that Alfred Marshall is the first generation of Cambridge as a school of thought, then you would conceive of Pigou as the second generation leader of that school of thought. He took over from Marshall when Marshall retired, and is seen typically as Marshallian. In some ways there's a difference in there. Pareto is seen as less Walrasian than Pigou is seen as Marshallian. Pareto and Walras fell out over methodology. So there's some differences, but there's a relevance there. Now, in the question of welfare, I'll sort of put this in context. Why welfare? Well, on the area of demand, there's a particularly important contribution that is most associated with Pigou, and that's externalities and market failure. In 1910, in a paper that he wrote called Producer Surplus and Consumer Surplus, again underlying his link to his master, Marshall, he introduced the formal analytics of market failure on supply and demand side. That subsequent work has emphasised the supply failures, that is, where producers do certain things which have externality impacts, and that's true of his own books as well. But in this very general case, you have a treatment that talks about market failure on demand side quite extensively and market failure on supply side. Well, the delightful feature of this to me when I picked that up as reading is that Pigou, when he is writing this whole treatise on introducing demand failure, is using the term ophelimity. Not sure of those of you are aware, but Pareto, in his Cours d'Economie Politique of 1896-97, 2-volume edition, was very, very concerned about the use of utility, the term utility, because it implied something was useful. And his concern was that there are many debates that can be had over the usefulness of something to an individual, usefulness to the society as a whole, and that it is almost impossible to construct a deductive analytical science based on such a variable and vague term as utility, when it can mean so many things to different people. So he introduced a neologism. He plagiarized Greek terminology and introduced ophelimity, where ophelimity is, in essence, a force that you act in response to satisfying a taste. There's no judgment about the legitimacy of that taste. It's just a force you react to it, if you like. There are different categories of ophelimity. For him, there's economic ophelimity, where you go in response to a particular good. There's ethical ophelimity, where in response to the pleasure you have from a certain ethical act, you may respond in a certain way. There's religious ophelimity. There's also religious utility, ethical utility, and economic utility. And his argument, his framing, was that essentially you look at ophelimity first because it is amenable to a deductive analytical framework. Then you try and take a step back and then look at questions of the broader question and the more important question of utility. Now, this appealed to Pigou, as it turned out, because he had come to a similar point by reading Sidgwick and other moral philosophers, Green. He cites in an earlier paper, Sidgwick, about hedonistic doctrine is dead. This is Sidgwick. You can't basically develop a system that, you can't have a system depend entirely on hedonism. So these are things that trouble Pigou as well, that he reflected on. And he found some insight, at least for Pareto, in, well, we've got multiple levels of influence, let's break them down. And he used, in this particular article, the term ophelimity. Why did he use it? He was trying to get at third-party effects. He was trying to look at, essentially, when you're looking at a demand curve, or the utility associated with an action is based on an individual's consumption of that action, you can sum the individual's utility quantity relationships and derive a market demand curve in a typical Marshallian sense. What's happening here is Pigou's recognising that, but that doesn't capture everything. In some ways, that analytical framework fails because there are many types of goods where I have regard for other people's demand. For example, my demand curve may not be independent of Marx's demand curve. And Marx may not be independent of others. So a fully specified function would have the good that I'm consuming plus the quantity that Marx is consuming, because that's affecting the amount of pleasure. And the examples of that he gives are things like top hats. You know, if there's not enough of us wearing top hats, we'll feel silly. If there's a lot of people wearing top hats and they're in a group that I aspire to be with, then I must have a top hat too, and from that will grow my demand. Now, this for him was part of a market failure, in that if you focus on the individual and the pleasure an individual gets from the good, when you do your market analysis, there'll be an externality that results, a demand side externality. So it's interesting too, from the point of view of going back to Pareto was too interested in, when he did utility theory, was interested in third party effects. If he introduced in 1916 a social welfare function, where it has essentially the utility that he receives, where each individual around the table receives, is based on the utility of every person. So my utility function is a personal one, but then I have a social welfare function where I would weight the utility of each person in the room. And then over that, a governing authority where they then take each of our social welfare functions, then weight each of our assessments and derive a welfare outcome. He does all that, though, within a framework of sociology, not within a framework of economics. And at heart of what he has to say is that this utility relationship doesn't have the stability of this ophelimity relationship, that what is good, socially good or socially bad, can't be observed in the way that you would observe a choice behaviour in a demand situation where you have constant repeat actions in like circumstances. When you take a function that takes an individual and how they think about others, and then just their action, the consistency is not there. So for him, this is the core element of why he divide economics and sociology. For Pigou, the answer is different. Pigou's saying, well, let me recognise this, but I want to keep it all within economics. this type of third-party analysis he wished to retain within economics. The end result is that between the two, Pigou created a system of economics that was broader in scope than Pareto's. As Pareto's work developed, he narrowed his scope, certainly of pure economics, to make room for sociology. So that part of the difference in scope between Lausanne and Cambridge comes through in this very specific question of how these two treated welfare. So the scope changes as a result. Now, another important point of similarity on the question of welfare is that both of them had a material interest. You'll all think, okay, Pareto, famous ordinalist, famous for introducing ordinalism, Pigou's famous for developing the old welfare economics, which wasn't predicated on ordinalism. But when you look at the two of them, that's not the core issue. The core issue is the material for economic welfare. What's the material conditions of people going? So that when Pareto did his welfare analysis, he generally didn't use ordinal analysis. He tended to use cardinal analysis. He used his ordinal analysis for looking at the conditions of equilibrium. So on that question, in fundamental areas, they're basically the same. On the second question, Pigou has three criteria for defining a welfare change. The first is that there's a relative change in material well-being. National income has risen by a certain amount. So if that occurs, we can tick a box and say, yes, there's been one of the criteria met for a welfare change. Pareto is on the same page. His analytics will give the same result. Pigou has a second criteria, and that second criteria is that the share of the national product that's produced and accrued to the poor rises. Okay, so that a larger share of that benefit has to accrue to the poor. That's his second criteria. That's a case that Pareto would not support. Pareto would not have that within his criteria of efficiency, of welfare. It's just the efficiency criterion, not a redistribution criterion. In his sociology, he doesn't hold to the Pareto condition of everyone winning. He looks at winners and losers and provides a framework for looking at redistribution, but it's not a condition of efficiency. The third condition that Pigou had is that the extent of fluctuations within the economy is diminished. So for him, for efficiency, you had to have an improvement in national income, you had to have an improvement in the share of national income that was accrued to the poor, and you had to have a reduction in the extent of fluctuations that occurred in the economy. If you put ticks in all of those three boxes, you had an unequivocal gain in economic welfare.
Fluctuation in what? In output? In prices? In
which one? The first one?
No, fluctuation.
Ah, okay. Yeah, no, so industrial fluctuations is an output, yeah.
Though
he does... He spends a lot of time, this is when he first starts to actually talk about quantity theory and stability of prices. So all that is discussed in the context of stability of prices as well. I mean, there's a fair bit in his book, Wealth and Welfare, on the quantity theory and stability of prices. But it's in the context of the output itself fluctuating. Pareto wrote a little bit about that, but not, again, within the context of a welfare economics. Now, a challenge occurred to Pigou, though, from Pareto, in that for Pigou, he's comes out of the moral sciences tradition, so he's caught between two worlds, if you like. Part of that movement out of the moral sciences tradition is this idea of subtlety and multiple criteria to look at when you're having a welfare gain. And he wants to accommodate the possibility of some sort of trade-off. So at heart, there's a utilitarian aspect to Pigou. Essentially, if a market is disturbed other than to correct the market, there's, in his terms, evil done. The question is the evil that is done outweighed by the benefit that would occur to the extra dollar that would be accruing to a poor person? Okay, so if there's some sort of intervention to recreate a redistribution, even in the case where we don't meet the first criteria, so that you have a reduction in outcome, in income rather than an increase, you can still conceive of a potential welfare gain because you value the the benefit to the poor person more highly than the loss to a wealthy person. The criticism, the issue that he confronted in the form of Pareto is that Pareto essentially, his analytical work was denying him that possibility. So, hence, Pigou had to confront some work of Pareto and dismiss it. And that work concerns Pareto's law of income distribution. So Pareto's law, in Pareto's words, he did some inductive analysis, there's some statistics to try and derive a curve of what the distribution curve looks like. And then he did some deductions based on the analytics of that curve. He said from this we can derive two very important theorems. The first of these teaches us that the distribution of income is not due to chance. So you see his curve there. X is income, N is the number of people, and X is income where if we start that point of view, H there, it's the number of people on income H or above. So it's not a, it's everyone above that point. And this is his essentially observing that inequality in the distribution of income is a phenomenon that appears in many, many instances. He took data from the 1500s in Florence where he could get data, some data from Peru, Paris, England, and generally derived a curve of that nature. He has a formula for it, etc. So it's he has an equation. But that's basically what that curve says. Now, if we took this as a probability density function, you'd have a curve that rises very steeply and then comes down. Because H here has everyone above a certain income, if it was just the people at that income H, you would have a curve that has a medium and mean to the left. Medium and mode is left of the mean, I think. Yeah, it's going to be twisted so that there's a big fat tail to the left.
Sorry, N is the number of people with that income or less?
Or more, the other. So H is the minimum income, so that segment says that that's how many people there are in the population. Now, he was criticised by Edgeworth and others, but, you know, for probability curves or for curves, you need to have them go back to the origins and with some justification, because at some stage this curve has to turn around and come in. Pareto's response was, I don't draw curves for ghosts, i.e. that at some level people will stop existing, so the pure mathematical argument doesn't hold in terms of the empirics. But that's the nature of the curve. He then took logs of the curve. And when you take that curve, you have a log of the number of people and the log of income, you get this line, straight line that emerges. And essentially that's the part of his first part is that this is not a Gaussian normal distribution. It's not due to chance. There's something that's going on in society that causes an inequality in distribution. And if you show it in log form, This is interesting to look at. The second part of the theorem is what Pigou challenged, because if he wants to have his suggestion, if he wants to have the proposition made that you can have a welfare gain even if there's a loss of total income because of the great benefit to the poor, this statement has to be wrong, this statement of Pareto. Pareto's statement here is that the increase in the level of the minimum or the reduction of inequality of income is necessary that wealth increases more rapidly than population. What you're having here is a classic trickle-down approach, that if there's a benefit, it will affect everybody. It may affect people who are wealthy more than the poor, but at least it will affect the poor somewhere. And if you wish to benefit the poor, redistribution's not necessary. Well, it's not the mechanism to do it if you want to achieve that outcome. So this is a very, very controversial statement. A lot of reactions to it, including Pigou's. Pigou's going to go most strongly. He took great issue with this. He challenged the relevance of this criterion. The problem for Pigou is that he didn't read Pareto carefully at all, and the attack is not well founded. this is what Pigou's essentially attacking, and this is part of Pareto's analysis, saying, okay, you've got the curve, there's the minimum income H. If you shift that curve to the right, everyone's better off, and the minimum income's risen. And in Pigou's analysis, Pareto's analysis of inequality, essentially it's the ratio of people over a certain income. If that changes such that more people have that higher income, inequality has diminished. So Pareto's analysis would do that. And Pigou's saying, okay, this is wrong because that curve's got to be able to change. That coefficient, that alpha, has to move, and we can play with that. The problem is that Pareto did this analytically rather than graphically. The problem is Pareto also varied alpha. So if H, the minimum income, is unchanged and the income of the poor rises, you actually have this sort of outcome. This outcome also requires an increase in total income. So Pareto was a challenge to Pigou. Pigou met the challenge for a long time. I don't know why people hadn't picked this oversight in Pigou's criticism of Pareto, but it largely hasn't, and so I've tried to address it in a recent paper. If Pigou wanted to follow this line, what he needed to say is that the problem is that this alpha is constant at all levels of income. But there's got to be a break somewhere along here for the very low incomes, and you can adjust it at the very low incomes and bring it in down at the high incomes. And that would give him justification for saying his second criteria for welfare enhancement is valid even when there's been a reduction in total income. A little bit conscious of the time too. So I'll move on to the section on monetary economics. Now, so you've got a paper, a classic paper that Pigou wrote, QJE paper called The Value of Money, which I think I incorrectly put in the abstract EJA paper. It was in the Quarterly Journal of Economics. This is a case where the person being mentored by Marshall reflects on what Marshall has said before various commissions of government and codifies it. We also see the beginnings of a difference between... I should say I'm totally in the camp that Pigou was a dedicated Marshallian, and I think a dedicated Marshallian is all about trying to pursue knowledge, even if that means clashing a little bit with the master. So I definitely see Pigou as a Marshallian. One of the areas where he differed was the relevance of equations in economics. Marshall, the great mathematician, was always preferred literary exposition, tried not to use equations if they could be avoided, or if they'd be in footnotes if it was absolutely necessary. Pigou later in life introduced equations into his analysis, and this is an example too where he's taking what Marshall has said, which is based on an equation, actually making the equation explicit. And then there's this unpublished paper that Pareto, the manuscript on the Note Critica di Teoria Monetaria, so a critical note on monetary theory from Fiorenzo Manati, published in Pareto's Complete Works. Pareto's Complete Works, by the way, are 32 volumes. He's a prolific writer. So the purpose of the paper that I'd like to discuss today is to reflect critically on the quantity theory and those. And I'm going to go through fairly quickly the mechanical sides of it, because much of it you will be familiar with, and if you are, it's less important than other parts of the paper. Pigou's formalisation of the quantity theory, we say, okay, Irving Fisher has written a book on the quantity theory, and he's used this equation. The basic form of the equation is given as MV, money times velocity equals nominal price times transactions. And this is the basis for analysing or presenting the quantity theory, that if velocity is constant, transactions don't change, M and the money stock and prices will move in the same direction. You increase money, you'll increase the price level, inflation will rise. Well, Fisher's version was a little bit different to Pigou's, but if we rejig Fisher's, Pigou was interested in the real the value of money, the real value of a currency. So if we call PW the price, the quantity of wheat that one unit of currency can buy, what Pigou is trying to do is trying to move away from the nominal price index, a price level that Fisher's using, to finding a real price indicator, what the price is. In effect, if the price of wheat is representative of wage goods in general, or the economy, consumer goods more broadly, then Pigou's price, PW, is equal to the inverse of Fisher's PN. It's equal to 1 over PN. So if that slight change, you can put the Fisher equation in that form. Pigou didn't like that form. He felt it was a little bit, it was too much of a flow argument. He wanted to have a stock argument. So he changed it by introducing KRW over M, where RW is the real resources available to the community. If you use wheat as your numeraire, is using the price of wheat as your numeraire, using wheat, it's the real value of the economy in wheat units. And K is the proportion of that real activity that's going on that's being kept as real cash balances. The portion of the real activity that's going on being kept for cash balances, either in coin or deposits in banks. And so his equation is that price, real price, is equal to real cash balances divided by the quantity that's in the market. So this is the demand side of this is the money demand equation. When you do that, if you stay within the Fisherian form, you end up with change in price is equal to change in quantity of money, or in the Pigouvian form, that change in price is equal to approximately negative over the percentage change in money. So he specified the equation. I'll do the Pareto one now because it's a little bit more complex. Pareto, it's unlikely that Pareto read Fisher. This is the time he'd moved away from economics, he'd moved to sociology. Unlikely that he read Purchasing Power of Money. Okay, he's read Fisher in various parts along his way, but it's unlikely that he did that. What he's probably read is Walras. Well, he definitely read Walras, and Walras' equations anticipate Fisher. Okay. What he did was he then stipulated that transactions times nominal prices, in this case it's nominal prices, I've got TW and PW, and where TW is equal to the transactions in wheat and PW is the nominal wheat price. And then TW is all other transactions and P star is all other prices. Pareto then devised an equation which is essentially the same as the Fisher equation. The bracketed term is just transactions times price from the Fisher equation. The V is velocity, M is money, and the alpha is something he's introduced himself. Well, it's just a Pareto thing. He's saying that for the economy as a whole, only a subset of all transactions are monetized. People give gifts. There's a transaction there. People sometimes pay in net terms. So he's taking out the range of transactions that, well, alpha indicates the proportion of total transactions which are monetarised. He then wants to look at change from year to year and introduces a real coefficient, where the real coefficient is 1 over 1 plus the growth rate. So if V is less than 1, you've got positive growth. If V is greater than 1, you've got negative growth. He then introduced a monetary coefficient, which is 1 over 1 plus the inflation rate, such that if U is less than 1, you've got positive inflation. If U is greater than 1, you've got deflation. And you then have this equation here. The key part is that V term is attempted to adjust the real economy. It's trying to say that in period N plus 1, if we take the transactions from the previous period, year 10, in year N, we have to divide that by this parameter here, by the growth rate. There's a change in the real sector. That's for wheat, and that's the real sector for all other goods. And the price, the nominal price, is being divided by U, which is this part here, which is the adjustment for the inflation effect. When you follow that through, Pareto's analysis says the change in price is equal to the growth rate minus inflation times 100. That's in percentage terms. And the change in money is equal to the growth rate plus the rate of inflation times 100. All of that means for the quantity theory to hold, G has to equal zero. The growth rate has to equal zero in his assessment. Pigou then came back after doing that basic equation, says, but we need to qualify it. And in needing to qualify it, he looked at a whole range of influences, such as the change in proportion of real activity that's held in cash balances. Some of that is due to the proportion that people hold in bank accounts and deposits changing. Other things is due to the amount that banks hold in reserve and don't pass on as loanable funds changing. Now, this is in some ways linking the proportion of cash balances to the real economy. He talks about expectations. Expectations are affected by the real economy, and that will affect the reserves that are being held. So at heart, Pigou is raising issues here which relate to the dichotomy between the real sector and the monetary sector. He's saying sometimes some elements of that dichotomy don't hold, and he tries to formally analyse how that can happen, how changes in the real sector can flow through to monetary behaviour. So he's qualifying what's going on. Pareto's concern was that neutrality can't exist. That is, you can't assume that growth is zero. You can't assume that there's no causal direction from the real economy to the monetary economy and the monetary economy back to the real economy. Both of them had a concern. I'll leave that. Now, when you look at the rhetoric, this is Pigou. At the outset, I insist that, though the machinery that I shall suggest in the following pages is quite different from that elaborated by Professor Irving Fisher in his admirable Purchasing Power of Money, and as I think more convenient, I am not in any sense an opponent of the quantity theory. But his analysis has broken down the idea of separating the real and monetary sectors totally. It has elements in it. But this is where his rhetoric comes from. He's not trying to destroy it, he's trying to qualify it. Pigou says, on the one hand, one has a theory, complete, simple, beautiful. It's a shame it does not accord too much with the facts. The reality is that there is only a relationship of interdependence, and to know the particulars of the relationship between prices and money's considerations other than money circulation, monetary circulation and prices are needed. I'll wrap this up really quickly. So there's three substantive differences. The first is, Pigou says, the question's not whether it's true or false. The question is that this equation gives us an instrument, a mode for thinking issues through. It's useful and can inform policy because it gives us a point of reference. Pareto says, no, the only way to look at this is, does the principle that prices refer to quantities of money, does that hold? Is that true? They see a different role for a monetary equation. That difference is a difference between Lausanne and Cambridge. The second thing is the treatment of the real sector. Pigou, although he breaks down the dichotomy between the real and the monetary sector, it's a causal direction. What happens in the real sector may flow through to the monetary relationship by means of the share that's held as cash balances. Pareto does not wish to have that. He wishes to have it both ways, that the monetary sector can change the real sector can change the monetary sector. For him, as he underlines, it's a relationship of interdependence. He doesn't wish also to have it, I'll go to the next point. Interdependence between real activity and monetary and money is critical to Pareto. He finds it in his expectation for other variables, and to find those explanations, you need to go to his sociology. His starting point is an article in the American Economic Review by Fisher, where he's looking at inflation in America during World War I, and is saying, in effect, this is a tax on bondholders to the rest of the community. Pareto reads this and says, if you agree with Professor Fisher, and how could you not, the only explanation for money is not in economics, it's in sociology. So he comes back to the point that there's a redistributive development. Where there's redistributive developments, that is government through fiscal policy, international trade policy or monetary policy, it's trying to take resources from one group to another. For Prado, it's not rich to poor, it's generally high interest speculators to low to others in the community who are rentiers, but not rentiers making large incomes. These are people who put their money in the 2% savings account and have it taken by others. And there's a whole form of analysis of Prado's sociology that relates to his views on money and fiscal policy that can be developed. So let me conclude now. I have raced over perhaps the most interesting parts at the end, but it's unavoidable and they can come up in discussion, hopefully. Prado and Pigou would agree that price levels and the quantity of money only move proportionally in highly qualified circumstances. That's only reading of both of them. That's, you can get that result, but it's very particular results, not a general result. They separate on the neutrality of money, with Prado emphasising interdependence between the real sector and money, Pigou not. Pigou implying a causation from the real sector to the monetary sector. This represents a broader difference in the use of equations and the standards by which you decide the use of equations between Lausanne and Cambridge. One, that is, the Parisian side is laws in society don't have exceptions. They interact with each other. All economic phenomena are influenced by social phenomena as well. So you try and do the best you can with your theory, but you still have to test it, whether it conforms with reality. And when you account for those interferences from other laws, other social laws, is it still relevant? So there's some sort of synthetic role, but it's still based on a judgment about does it conform to fact. Whereas in the Cambridge one, there is, certainly in the case of Pigou and the quantity theory, is what better is there for usefully exploring these ideas? That's his criteria. So, fact verification versus a mode of thinking. Now, curiously, this point somebody had made to me, which I'll use, you have an unusual emphasis. So you have the Cambridge emphasis on an equilibrium state with money and in the monetary world, and that's more emphasised than Lausanne. And typically, you think of Lausanne, that's general equilibrium. They push equilibrium to the nth degree, to agree that's greater than the case that is pushed in the Cambridge form of analysis associated with Marshall. This turns that relationship on its head. I would conclude by adding that that's perhaps the whole Parisian program, is to turn that relationship on its head. It's where he deviates from Warras by introducing sociology and trying to reduce the scope of pure economics and make a little bit wider scope for sociological thought. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. That's great. I don't know how many of you have actually read the paper, but Michael has written a very fine paper, I think, teasing out the subtle but important differences between Pigou and Pareto in their understandings of the limits and relevance of the quantity equation to a theory of money, or indeed of the monetary economy. And my interest in Pigou, this is the Keynes seminar after all, is as Keynes's foil in the intellectual process that led to the general theory. And part of the difficulty of the general theory is that it is really addressed to Pigou, I think. It can sometimes feel like Keynes is asking us to listen in on a private conversation conducted in a private Cambridge language without giving us the full context. That might be a little unfair to Keynes, but it's certainly true that Keynes goes to great lengths in Chapter 2 and Book 5 of the General Theory to address Pigou's arguments as developed and presented to Keynes over a period of, I suppose, 20 years. So I'm quite sure that Keynes would agree that we should be taking Pigou seriously. So that's the first point. And I think it's important to recognise that Pigou was at least grappling, if arguably unsuccessfully, with what we would now call macroeconomic problems of greater complexity and importance than modern macro is prepared to settle for. I'm thinking in particular of the whole question of the heterogeneity of output and capital. We don't just have one commodity model here. And these are major concerns of post-Keynesian economics, at least, well, and in particular, at any rate, of the Sraffian variety. And Pigou took that seriously. The part of the paper I find most interesting is just the final bit about rhetoric, really, and the implicit views of causation that the two authors held about the way the quantity theory works. I think, as you pointed out, Pigou is wedded to the idea of the neutrality of money, the classical dichotomy by which the real variables in the economy are determined by real factors and processes, leaving money on the other side of the moon, as Keynes put it, simply to determine the price level. Thus, Pigou's qualifications of the quantity theory sound very modern to me. A division between the short run, in which all manner of things can affect the relationship between money and prices, but in the long run, the quantity theory must hold. And Pareto, by contrast, displays more scepticism. I like the quotation along the lines, nice theory, shame about the facts, or more fully, the reality is that there is only a relationship of interdependence. And to know the particulars, considerations other than monetary circulation and prices are needed. And furthermore, these considerations have to go beyond the merely economic into the area of sociology. And this is music to my ears, having just attended a conference in honour of Jeff Ingham here in Cambridge, who has consistently taken this line over the nature of money and interest. Jeff was the last, perhaps the only, sociologist to be a member of the Faculty of Economics and Politics, as it then was. And his major book, which is entitled appropriately enough The Nature of Money, would, I suspect, have been greeted by Pareto with approval. So let me now just talk briefly about Keynes's relationship with the quantity theory. As I said earlier, Keynes went out of his way to meet Pigou and to take his arguments seriously. Therefore, in the general theory, he does not simply dismiss the quantity theory, but devotes chapters 20 and 21 to making the connection between it and the principle of effective demand. And this proved to be a very costly concession by Keynes, I think, in terms of the reception of the general theory. For two reasons. The first is that Keynes made some simple mathematical errors in his final text. And whether this was a matter of proofreading or not, the impression was created that Keynes was a bit slipshod and could not really do the math, as our American cousins put it. This undermined Keynes's legitimate criticisms of the excessive use of mathematics in economics, which is, as he wrote, and I've got a big paragraph which I won't quote completely, but he says, "It is a great fault of symbolic pseudo-mathematical methods of formalising a system of economic analysis, such as we shall set down in this chapter, that they expressly assume strict independence between the factors involved. Too large a proportion of recent mathematical economics are mere concoctions, as imprecise as the initial assumptions they rest on, which allow the author to lose sight of the complexities and interdependencies of the real world in a maze of pretentious and unhelpful symbols." So making a simple error in the algebra was, in this context, shooting himself in the foot rather badly. Pages 305 to 306 for those who wish to check. The second expensive concession, and I should just add, that's not my discovery, that's been known for donkey's years. The second expensive concession, more subtle but of greater substance, arose directly from Keynes's attempt to reconcile the two theories, the quantity theory of money and his own. He creates his own mathematical concoction, a money stock elasticity of the price level as a replacement for the quantity equation. And the value of Keynes's elasticity can range between 0 and 1, whereas in the quantity theory it's only equal to 1 in the long run. So Keynes therefore offers a generalization of quantity theory which contains, as it should, the quantity theory as a special case. But there's a big price for doing this, and that is the assumption of homogeneous output. He writes, provided that we can find some sufficiently satisfactory method of measuring output, it is also useful to define what may be called the elasticity of output or production. And although this concession is absolutely necessary in order to engage with the quantity theory, it undermines all Keynes's hard work in chapters 4 and 5 of the General Theory, in which he takes such pains to show that the concept of homogeneous output is essentially unscientific. As when he writes, you may know this quote, to say that net output is greater but the price level lower than 10 years ago or 1 year ago is a proposition of a similar character to the statement that Queen Victoria was a better queen but not a happier woman than Queen Elizabeth. A proposition not without meaning and not without interest, but unsuitable as material for the differential calculus. Our precision would be a mock precision if we try to use such partly vague and non-quantitative concepts as the basis of a quantitative analysis. And it may not be an overstatement to claim that Keynes's unrequited attempt to engage Pigou led Hansen later on to write down the symbol Y to represent aggregate output and thereby take the first step towards the establishment of a Keynesian school, of which Keynes himself memorably stated he was not a member. Treating aggregate output as a scalar variable and assuming fixed prices permitted the Keynesians to go straight from aggregate demand to output, and to bypass Keynes's principle of effective demand, which is a rich and complex animal involving heterogeneous relative prices, short-term rational expectations. Had the principle of effective demand been fully understood as a superior concept of competitive equilibrium to that of classical general equilibrium, Lucas and Co. would never have been able to reduce macro to micro. Even Joan Robinson and the post-Keynesians preferred to adopt the non-competitive formulation of the principle of effective demand put forward by Kaletsky rather than Keynes's. Pareto never read Keynes' general theory, but I suspect he would have warmed to the section where Keynes considers the long-term relationship between money and the price level and offers an explanation of its perceived long-term stability. Prefacing his remarks with a statement that this is a question for historical generalization rather than pure theory, Keynes suggests that a rough relationship between money and prices arises from two opposing tendencies of a sociological character. So this is in the general theory itself. On the one hand, there may be a limit on how much money people will hold idle, provided that the rate of interest exceeds a certain figure, where both the limit and the minimum rate of interest are grounded in psychology. If the supply of money and the rate of interest exceed these figures, the rate of interest will fall and the price level will eventually tend to rise, although discontinuously and not in accordance with any mathematical function. On the other hand, if there's a persistent shortage of money, society will tend to respond by devising new ways of creating it. since the alternative of cutting wages and the price level has such unpalatable consequences in terms of labour unrest and bankruptcy by debt deflation, as Fisher pointed out. So Keynes argued that the 19th century represented, on average, a socially tolerable combination, a balance of forces between employers and workers over money wages, and between debtors and creditors over financial innovation. And it was the loss of this balance after the First World War that resulted in unacceptable levels of unemployment and pressure for political change, which came to pass in the aftermath of the Second War. And Western governments then took responsibility for full employment and, to varying degrees, for social welfare in the settlement leading to what is now seen in retrospect by some, at any rate, as a golden age of economic growth from 1950 to 73. So, in conclusion, I mean, Keynes was essentially emphasising that there are limits to economics. You can only, even though he was proposing a general theory, this was not a universal theory. It was a general theory only in the sense that it contained the classical theory. And he recognised, particularly in the theory of interest, that in the end you have to go beyond where Pigou was. You can't extend economics into sociology, or only so far. You have to actually make a jump into a different discipline. And finally, I think Michael's paper reminds us of the value of studying the great thinkers in our field. I would personally never have expected to find Keynes's thinking congenial to Pareto, though we'll never know, of course. But that's the suggestion you're making, I think. And if so, long live the history of economic thought, is all I can say.